From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, LeBron James is coming to play for the Lakers and maybe also ramp up his side job as a movie and TV producer. Then Deborah Granik's new film, Leave No Trace, is about a veteran living off the grid. Like all of Granik's movies, it's not the kind of story that Hollywood wants to tell, and she's fine with that.
There's no desire in me to enter into that machinery, that behemoth, only because it's not my culture.
And we meet a queer singer-songwriter who's turning bro country anthems on their head. All that coming right up. Los Angeles is abuzz today with the news that NBA star LeBron James has decided to leave the Cleveland Cavaliers and sign with the Lakers. It's big news for basketball, definitely, but it also might mean something for James's career in film and TV. James is no stranger to Hollywood. He got some pretty good reviews for playing himself in the 2015 comedy Trainwreck. Here in that film, he gives some relationship advice to his doctor, played by Bill Hader.
What I'm saying is you got to go for it. Listen, Aaron, you need to focus if you want to take it to the next level.
Right.
You have to. Like, you got to give it everything you want if you want this one, man. It's like when I lost the championship in 2011, I worked on my game twice as hard.
Yeah.
Worked on my post-up game, and we wound up winning the championship twice.
Yeah, yeah. I don't feel like that applies to me, but I appreciate the thought.
James has his own production company. It's called Spring Hill, and it's based right here in Burbank. Tatiana Siegel is a senior film writer at The Hollywood Reporter, and she's been writing about what LeBron James's move to L.A. could mean for his film and TV ambitions. When I reached her by phone, she explained more about James's production company, Spring Hill.
The company is run by LeBron and his high school buddy, Maverick Carter. It is mostly in the television business, but they do have a few movies in development at Warner Brothers, which is where their offices are. And the movies that they have in development that are most noteworthy is a House Party reboot. And he's got the Atlanta writers writing the screenplay for it. So a couple of Atlanta writers. So that seems very promising. And then either more promising or less promising, depending upon your perspective, is a Space Jam reboot. I don't know if you were a fan of the Space Jam with Michael Jordan back in the day, but, you know, some people felt like it was a missed opportunity in the sense that you had the dream team of basketball stars with Michael Jordan and Larry Bird and Charles Barkley. It never really sort of had the big international or domestic audience come to see it that you would think it would. But I think Warner Brothers is very hopeful that with LeBron's international appeal, that movie would do great in a new era.
And what you're describing, too, doesn't sound like a vanity deal. It actually sounds like LeBron has been active with his partner, that this isn't just some side hobby, but they have actually been developing material and trying to get things made.
Yeah, I think they've been very savvy. They also, like on the TV front, for example, they're producing a series based on a British kind of crime drama called Top Boy. And they're doing that with music superstar Drake. And it's like the most unlikely players you would think of to bring a British TV show to Netflix. But, you know, that's one of the projects that's on LeBron's TV slate. So I always thought that was very interesting.
Are there any models in recent history for athletes who have had second or parallel careers in Hollywood? I can think of Magic Johnson, who's been successful as an entrepreneur, like with Starbucks. The football player John Elway has car dealerships and restaurants. But has there been a good example of an athlete turned successful producer?
You know, that is a great question. And I sort of pondered this question when I recently did a Shaquille O'Neal profile a couple of weeks ago when Shaq was about to star in this movie, Uncle Drew. And, you know, only a few of the former athletes like Michael Jordan and Shaq have high Q ratings. They have great recognizable qualities, and they can be put into commercials and films, and people will sort of show up for them. But there's not many of them. And Michael Jordan, he pretty much doesn't do any film or TV stuff. He's doing commercials and he's making a ton of money. Shaq is doing both commercials and producing some TV shows and doing some movies and getting into the game show game. And, you know, he's trying to make a push into Hollywood and using his former NBA status as one of the most likable athletes to ever play to his favor. But it really hasn't been done that much.
Yeah, and obviously Kobe Bryant won an Oscar for his short film. But I'm wondering, more broadly speaking, are there attributes that somebody like LeBron has? He's not only an incredible athlete, but he's also unbelievably durable. He's a great leader. Are there skills that he would have as an athlete that could translate into being a successful producer?
Yeah, I think that one of the other things that is not to be underestimated is how much people want to work with somebody like that. He is so, he brings just a lot of drama, and not bad drama, but good drama to any project. Like, you know, you get to be in the presence of LeBron James. That is like sort of a Mick Jagger kind of moment, where a lot of people, you know, who are used to being around famous people all day, sort of are like, wow, that's like, you know, that person does something I could never dream of doing. And I think that he's just so professional. He, you know, I remember visiting the set of Trainwreck a few years ago, and you could see him doing, like, it was like a 100-degree day in New York City, and he would do take after take, and he sort of just had a professionalism that I was certainly impressed by.
And the most important question, do you have friends who have season tickets? And if so, have you reached out to them already?
I do not have any friends with season tickets, but I'm a Celtics fan, so I'll just kind of, I won't have much to say on it anyway.
Tatiana Siegel is a senior film writer at The Hollywood Reporter. Tatiana, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Anytime, John. Thank you.
And in other entertainment news, prosecutors in New York City today charged Harvey Weinstein with three additional felony sex charges. Two of the charges carry a maximum penalty of life behind bars for the disgraced producer. District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. said in a statement that his investigation is continuing and that Weinstein, who pled not guilty to earlier charges last month, has been charged with, quote, some of the most serious sexual offenses that exist under New York's penal law, unquote. Coming up, not everyone wants to make movies with Hollywood studios like Deborah Granick, the Oscar-nominated filmmaker of Winter's Bone. She's back with a new movie that she made independently and very much off the grid.
KPCC supporters include Center Theater Group, presenting The Humans, Stephen Karam's 2016 Tony Award winner for Best Play. Charles McNulty of the Los Angeles Times said, The Humans has come to L.A. at full strength. If there's a better ensemble working in America right now than the extraordinary cast of The Humans at the Amundsen Theater, I'm unaware of its existence. The Humans, featuring the original Broadway company, only at the Amundsen, now through July 29th. More information at AmundsenTheater.org.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. And now, 8 years ago, a young actress was introduced to the big screen in a very small film. The movie was called Winter's Bone, and the actress was, of course, Jennifer Lawrence. Now the filmmaker of Winter's Bone has a new movie in theaters. Deborah Granick has written and directed Leave No Trace. It tells the story of a veteran with PTSD living off the grid with his teenage daughter in the Pacific Northwest. In this scene, they're discovered by police in a national park. The father, played by Ben Foster, is arrested. His daughter, Tom, is played by newcomer Thomason McKenzie.
Tom, come out! Stand up. Come on.
Dad?
Hold on there. Cooperate. We haven't done anything wrong. Cooperate. We don't know who you are, what's going on. Let's go.
I met with Deborah Granick when Leave No Trace premiered at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, and we began with what draws her, an East Coast urbanite, to stories about outsiders in unfamiliar settings.
I'm always interested in something I don't know, right? So if it's a part of the country I don't know, if it's a way of navigating that I don't know, if it's a set of customs I don't know, if it's even a set of beliefs that I don't know how they form, and I know that mine are different, but I want to know why those hold sway for the other person. So there is definitely an intrinsic curiosity in others, which would be the same kind of calling maybe as a visual anthropologist, you know, or even branches of sociology, where you're wondering, in these 7 winters that we have, you know, how are you going to do what you do? Why do you make these choices? Why do I make mine? Why do you make yours? You know, so those queries constantly turn my brain on.
This film is an adaptation of a book by Peter Rock called My Abandonment, which itself is an adaptation of a true story. So as it progresses from true story to book to film, was there a core idea from the very beginning that you found attractive that you wanted to reflect in this story?
Most definitely. And that is the notion that through a kind of ardor, a discipline, a philosophy, someone could carve out a life against the grain, attempt to sustain that, do it as to be undetected for a very long time, and then also try to teach some of that to their offspring. And going against the grain, I don't think any of us really can fathom what that really means. It is a fierce decision that requires determination. So I was, who is this person? And who is his daughter? Or say, who is this daughter and who is her father? You know, you can go either way there. You know, they are dyads, so they are, you know, inextricably linked in the story and how you might come upon them and view them. But their method of living was absolutely vibrantly magnetic to me.
But you raise a really interesting question. How do we view them? Because I think this, a lot of the stories you tell, it's so much about the way that audiences or, you know, mainstream audiences would see and judge a person based on the decisions that he or she makes. But you're not interested in judging these people. You're interested in letting their actions more or less speak for themselves.
To want to know why people do things requires some suspension of judgment. It's, you can just decide, wow, that freaks me out. I feel like there's a chasm between us. I choose not to do that, or that scares the daylights out of me, or, you know, I don't know why you do that, or I actually am super uncomfortable with why you do that. You can have all those judgments. Those exist, and you can't encounter another person with ways of being that are very different and not have some of those at some point. But to try to depict them, you have to stop at why and what does it look like. You can't answer and you can't really judge. Now, that doesn't mean that people who are viewing the story can't try to decipher what they feel. But then I would be foreclosing that, right? And I don't want to foreclose hardly anything. I want us to think together, really.
I think the studio version of this film answers all those questions and decides how an audience should or should not judge Will, and how we should or should not judge his parenting, and how he should be accountable for the choices he's made, which is probably why you're not making studio movies.
I think that's probably true. You know, I think without dissing us as a culture, American film culture and American storytelling, and even American culture in the broadest sense, you know, it has been said to me many times that from people from other countries that they view a lot of our culture as very black and white, that we are known in this world to be a young country with some very green ways of looking at life, some very underdeveloped.
Green as in naive.
Green as in naive. Or wanting absolutes. Who doesn't want to know the truth or know that there's some truth? That it's so uncomfortable to know that everything, that most things are relative, that there are multiple truths, that every story most likely is partly a Rashomon, you know, and we are intrinsically uncomfortable with that. We want to know, is it right or is it wrong? We've wanted to know that from our heritage with puritanical attitudes. We've wanted to know that with the rise of the new Christian right, you know, which is a very vast part of our country. It's about wanting to know, is there someone up there running the show? Is there someone that created frogs? Yes or no? You know,
which is a line from the movie, God created frogs.
Well, that was in a brochure in the vestibule of a church. And I want to just put that out there. That is a question that is being discussed in this country that is really struggling to get along with each other on some level on some of those fundamental questions about whether we can accept the and whether we can accept gray areas and ambiguity. or whether we have to know absolutes.
We're talking with Deborah Granick. Her new movie is called Leave No Trace. If people were to look at your films, Down to the Bone with Vera Farmiga, Winter's Bone with Jennifer Lawrence, and Leave No Trace with Thomasine McKenzie, people could come to the very rational and reasonable conclusion that you have a great aptitude for spotting and developing young actors. And how would you explain your ability to find these actors and to get them to do such remarkable work at a young age?
These three actors, you know, they were hungry, determined, hardworking, soulful, dig deep actors. They're people who want to get inside a story, understand it to its innermost part, bring part of themselves to it, but keep working and learn from their co-players, give back a whole lot. All three of them are very generous co-players, right? So staying very present, really answering, really listening, you know. So it's not something I spot and develop. It's that I have I would say I have a desire to work with such a person. And then they show me a sign that they are also interested.
It's been, 8 years since you were here with Winter's Bone. There are other women who have taken a long time to get films made. And I wonder how much of that is related to the kinds of stories you want to tell and how much of that is related to the obstacles that any female filmmaker faces.
I think it's the former. You know, the lives of poor Americans and the lives of working Americans can be inherently not glamorous. And I think filmmakers I'm in a big school of filmmakers called neorealists, you know, we will always struggle because there's a part of film that's been associated, especially in this bigger culture of West Coast industrial filmmaking, with escapism or thrilling, but abdication of the real, right? And no judgment there. I'm just saying, but it makes sometimes realism, social realism, a little bit less saleable.
I think that's true. But I also think it's true that if you look at the history of directors who've come to Sundance or other film festivals and done incredibly well with very personal but compelling stories, the number of men who are able to go from that to a big studio film is very long. Taika Waititi, Justin Lin, Colin Trevorrow, Ryan Johnson. And when you think about the women, and I think there are plenty of women who they want to make those bigger movies and they don't get as many chances as the men.
Yeah. But I think I am in a category that the movies or the things you've just mentioned are not the nary the two shall meet, right? I've had to use this metaphor. I came up with it because it somehow rang a bell in my brain. There's big ag, right? Like big pharma, big oil. There's big industrial movie making.
And you're the organic
farmer.
And
I'm the organic farmer. I mean, I don't want to repeat myself. I did say this already since arriving in Utah. You know, there's farmers markets and there's a growing culture for slow foods movement, for, you know, for all the things that are smaller, humbler, quieter. There is a subculture that appreciates stuff like that or that gravitates towards that. So there's no desire in me to enter into that machinery, that behemoth, only because it's not my culture. You know, it needs to exist and it has and it's formed a lot of our lives. It's put its imprint on a lot of our own imaginations, for better or for worse, but it's not something that I seek to participate in.
Deborah Granick, thanks for coming on the show.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was filmmaker Deborah Granick. Her latest movie, Leave No Trace, is in theaters now. Coming up, singer-songwriter Sam Buck and his boyfriend played to country music audiences in the South. We hear why the reception surprised them. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Now, singer-songwriter Sam Buck has been described as the gay king of bro country. Inspired by Nashville recordings from the 1990s, he tells queer coming-of-age stories that range from introspective to bawdy. The LA-based musician and painter just released his self-produced EP, Borderline. Buck also regularly hosts an LGBTQ-friendly country review and line dance in central LA. But like many do-it-yourself musicians, he makes his living through non-musical means. Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett recently spoke with Buck, who is joined by his collaborator and boyfriend, Sam Zimmon.
I'm Sam Buck, and I'm a musician. I'm also Sam. I'm the boyfriend and I'm in the band.
I feel like style-wise, I always say, like, we're more like Walmart parking lot than we are Rhinestone Cowboy or something, yeah. You know? Said, in this town, there's
only basics and to the wall. And I think there is a certain level of drag that goes into what we do a little bit.
I like to play with having a masculine look and sort of a more feminine stage presence. So put on a jersey. Now every
man wants me, but I have no interest in the men. Typically the setup of our show is me almost like a DJ with a microphone and Sam with a guitar.
I don't think it makes sense, but yeah. It makes sense to us. And when I started like wearing a cowboy hat on stage, it made more sense to people that they could identify it as country. We were on tour recently in Texas, and we're used to playing in LA, and you know, we're from the Northeast. Like, a lot of our friends couldn't even really tell that we were playing country. The reaction would sometimes be, oh, I can't really hear how it's country, but
I like it.
Then when we got to Texas, people were like, sounds like Shania meets Arthur Russell or something, you know? Little pink light burning in the dark, and no one's gonna love you like you love yourself. I was nervous about playing in like Alabama and Texas. You know, I felt like as a gay couple, like we sort of would come out every night on stage. Like, I feel like we got more love from those audiences because they were compensating for like perceived bigotry. We got a lot of love for being gay.
We did it as like sort of a boost to our...
You know, because we've been together for... Almost 10 years.
Almost 10 years, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to mention that. I want some claps. Playing music and just sort of getting started at this point, it doesn't pay any bills. I myself... clean apartments right now, which is something I've done for the last 10 years off and on.
Yeah, this place, I was honestly just here a few days ago because it's an Airbnb.
I find it rewarding. It's meditative. I mean, it can also be torture, obviously. You don't want to surprise people with the fact that you're like a 6 foot tall man when you come to clean their house. So I put on my Craigslist ad. Like, I made my headline friendly gay guy cleaning service. And I immediately got a response from a guy who runs a gay guy cleaning service. So, like, I didn't get clients that way, but now I work for this guy who runs a cleaning service of just gay guys, which I don't really get the appeal, but at the same time, like, sure. When I was 12, I chose that I was just gonna be a musician, and that was sort of like a declaration. Turned around, I never would have stopped. You know, I used to put on shows in my hometown, and I always loved like making flyers, putting them up, making my CD artwork. I just love the process, and it just comes naturally to me. So the Country Review is a show I do, and the concept is I put together a band and we back up different singers. It's like a fast-paced variety show. We got some choreography in there. It's a pretty queer expression of country, but that's just based on who we are, I guess, you know?
I will see people there at the Review and they're fully like
dressed up in country drag with a bolo tie and a cowboy hat, and they're singing along to some of these songs. So I think that for some people, it is really exciting to come to this event like that they never thought would happen with this sort of scene of queer art people in LA.
I don't feel like I'm playing with country. I feel like it really did choose me and that I feel very committed to it. We're married.
What, you and country?
Yeah. Till death do us part.
Just because they're bad men doesn't mean a thing.
Yeah.
I find no comfort with them.
And that will do it for today. Remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll be back here tomorrow. Yeah.